Okay, so why don't we go ahead and start? My name is Carrie, and I am one of the guiding teachers at Seattle Insight. Can everybody hear me okay? Give me a thumbs up. Great. Okay, wonderful. And I'm very happy to host and introduce Devin and Nico Haase tonight. I'll just offer a short introduction and then turn the evening over to them. So we're very fortunate to have them join us tonight. So soon after the launch of their recent book. So as many of you probably know, Devin has practiced extensively since the year 2000 in both the Insight and Vajrayana traditions, studying closely with Joseph Goldstein, Tara Brach, Mingyur Rinpoche, and others. So prior to Dharma teaching, Devin was a classroom teacher for 10 years. She's a graduate of the Community Dharma Leader Program at Spirit Rock and IMS's teacher training program at Insight Meditation Society, and now helps coordinate the Community Dharma Leader Program at Spirit Rock. Nico has practiced extensively in the Insight, Zen, and Vajrayana traditions, and has spent much of the first decade of the 21st century in a Zen monastery. He has a PhD in counseling psychology from UW-Madison and has studied with Mingyur Rinpoche, Lama Drukgyu Tenzin, and Joseph Goldstein since 2013. So both Devin and Nico completed a Tibetan 3-year retreat during the COVID years and now have an online community called Refuge of Belonging. So their first book was called How Not to Be a Hot Mess: A Buddhist Survival Guide for Modern Life. And as I mentioned last month, they launched their second book, This Messy, Gorgeous Love: A Buddhist Guide to Lasting Partnership. And I'm so excited that you two wrote this book. I think I can count just maybe two or three Dharma books written by partnered people about partnership. So, I was lucky enough to have been sent a copy of this book a few weeks ago, and it's very honest and personal and fun and full of very practical wisdom drawn from the Buddhist tradition from people who are really living it out. So, I really, really appreciated it, have been appreciating it. Devin and Nico have said, we poured everything we had into these pages, everything we've learned about love and marriage and dharma and making partnership a genuine path to awakening. So thank you for writing the book. Thank you for being here and really looking forward to an evening of practice and dialogue together. So I will hand it over to you too. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Carrie. That was such a touching intro, and I feel so grateful to be here with your Sangha. It's so nice to see a lot of familiar faces here with us. Thank you for coming, and also new friends. We've been doing a lot of these different events, mostly from our apartment. I'm in the office. Nico's right next door in the living room. But we've been doing this online tour, and it's been really touching to kind of dip into all of these different communities all around the country and the world. And so every time people show up in these Zoom boxes, I'm just like so moved. Like, thank you for coming and for practicing with us. And this book is a really honest look at our relationship and what we've learned. And also, we're learning so much from the dialogue and the interface of, when people actually read this, what happens, and what's your experience of the practices in this book. And I know many of you probably do a lot of these practices that we'll talk about this evening already. So we're kind of framing this as a conversation, and it's just an honor. Thank you, Carrie and Tim and Tuere and everyone who has been part of supporting this event. I know it's a big effort. So We're going to start with a meditation. Nico's going to guide us in deep listening, and then I'll read a little bit. We'll have some story time and then some shared reflections and discussion.
Yeah, thank you all so much. Very nice to be here with you. And if my voice is a little hoarse, it's because I just came from a dance party and I was screaming Whitney Houston at the top of my lungs. It was real. It was real. But I'm very happy to be with you in a much quieter environment. My friends are still dancing. I might join them again after this. And we'll do a meditation that's coming from the book. There's this practice that we find really foundational to any relationship. And I think a lot of what we talk about in the book and in our teaching, it's not just about partnership, it's around intimacy more generally. So your relationships with friends and your children, parents, coworkers, sangha members, oh my God. All I think can benefit from this practice of what we call deep listening, which is how we translate the word sati. Sati, often translated as mindfulness or bare awareness or attention. We like to think of it as a deep listening. And so we'll do this meditation that comes at near the beginning of the book, and we build much of the rest of the practices of the book from this one meditation, deep listening. And so maybe we'll sit together for, I don't know, 25 minutes or something like that. So you want relax into a posture that's going to be comfortable for you for a little less than half an hour. I like to rock back and forth a little bit. Kind of get into my body. You might allow your eyes to close. If it's comfortable for you, you could take a couple of deeper breaths. And then just allow your breath to be ordinary as it is. If it's short, let your breath be short. If it's long, let your breath be long. And we'll invite a warm awareness, a kind attention into your feet. What do your feet feel like right now? Really see how curious you could get about your feet. It's like you're feeling your feet from the inside. And this, of course, is a kind of listening, a friendliness. It's like a deep listening to the sensations of your own feet. And so we'll do this in silence for just a few minutes, really getting into how it feels in our feet. And then as you're ready, you could invite that same warm awareness, that deep listening into your hands. And again, it's like you've never felt your hands before. It's that kind of curiosity or freshness. Really feeling, are your hands warm? Are they cool? Touching something coarse or smooth, soft? What's the experience like in your hands? Can you bring a really genuine interest, which is a kind of listening, into your own hands? And now, if you'd like, you can invite that same listening, that same sustaining attention to your heart. What is alive in your heart? What's here? Is it joy or sorrow, irritation, anxiety? What's alive in your heart? And seeing if you can soften any expectation or demand that your heart be a particular way. And just meet exactly what is here. Maybe even softening into whatever is alive in your heart. And at some point, you will notice that your mind has wandered and gone to the future or the past, or maybe evaluating the present. That's natural. That's just what the mind does. When you notice that you've been lost, you could just come back with a lot of friendliness and interests. Just come back to listening to your own heart. What's here now? What's it like now? Coming back again and again, feeling your heart from the inside. And when you're ready, you could take another couple of deeper breaths and let your body begin to rock. Let your body start moving. Open your eyes, stretch. And so even as we start to move and stretch, and we're going to take a 5 minute break here. So even as we move into a break, see if it's possible to keep some of the continuity of that listening. So see if you can continue with the listening to your body. See if you can continue the listening to your own heart. And this is, you know, maybe this 5 minutes is like one of the more important 5 minutes of the evening, because this is your chance to see what it's like just in the short period to continue that listening. And if you can invite that continuity for 5 minutes, then you can invite it into the whole rest of your life and into doing dishes, into having conversations, into riding a bus. There can be like this sustaining listening that you bring with you everywhere you go. And that's a real gift. So let's just take 5 minutes, take a break, do whatever you need to do, and then we'll come back at 40 minutes after the hour for some story time. See you in a bit.
Hey friends, if you're near your device, we can start gathering again. I hope you got some tea maybe and a blanket, cozy up for story time. You'll see this book is full of our stories, and mostly it's like what not to do in partnership. And this is one of those. So I thought I would just read from chapter one, very beginning of the book. This is the first story, and chapter one is called Relationships Are Rough. One beautiful autumn day, we were camping in our van on a friend's farm in the Northeast Kingdom in the far reaches of Vermont, just shy of the Canadian border. The foliage burst forth in a bright weave of oranges, reds, and yellows, the sun reaching through the leaves in shafts of gentle light. The sky blue as a robin's egg. It was the perfect day to take pictures for our website. The weather was right. The foliage was at peak. Our beloved friend, Isabella, a gifted photographer, was staying next door. There was only one problem. I dislike having my picture taken strongly. No, actually two problems. I had also forgotten that we were supposed to take pictures at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday morning, right as I was revving up to respond to dozens of emails from students, colleagues, trainees, and other beloved, but sometimes high maintenance Buddhists and meditators. Oh, and a third problem, I was tired, like really tired. Not just that kind of sleepy tired you get when you need a little nap, but that desperate tired you get when you've been living in a 70 square foot van with your partner for the past year. We've been traveling far and wide, teaching much too much with not enough breaks, and my whole body, heart, mind was going into lockdown. Everything felt like way too much. I don't do well when I'm that kind of tired. And so when Nico walked up to the van at 8:50 a.m., all full of sunshine, and said cheerily, "Ready to take some pictures?" I didn't even look up from my laptop. "What pictures?" I said. He paused. I could feel him bristle. "Carefully," he said, "the pictures that we're scheduled to do with Isabella in 10 minutes. I still didn't look up from my screen. "You know," he pressed on, "for our website." "I don't want to take pictures," I said. I heard him take a breath. I could feel him digging for some relational skills. For some reason, that just made me feel more stubborn, more annoyed. Yeah, he said, pictures are no fun. I don't really like pictures either, but we haven't done them in a while, and we need them for our website and for when we send out bios and for Instagram. If you hadn't shaved your beard, I said, we wouldn't need these new pictures. I glanced up to watch that one land. I saw hurt cross my partner's face and then anger. The Buddha likened speech to an axe. You can use an axe for good things, for shaping wood into beams for a barn or making kindling to heat your home. But if you're not careful, you can use that axe as a weapon. I was perfectly aware that I was in the process of using speech as a weapon, but in my tiredness, I also felt really irritable, and smiling for a photograph at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday was looking like a total impossibility, an encroachment. More than that, a lie. And I just couldn't bring myself to say something kind or skillful in the face of all this piling wrongness. So, in a moment of emotional free fall, I said the one thing I knew would blow the whole conversation to smithereens. I'm not doing the pictures. That's when Nico lost it. I don't remember exactly what he said, but it wasn't pretty. And I don't remember what I said back, but I can assure you it did not adhere to any of the carefully formulated suggestions we'll be making throughout this book. Nope, it was like we were riding a tandem bike downhill fast, both of us pedaling furiously away, tit for tat, getting more petty by the second. Did we drag up past hurts? Yes, indeed. Did we fall into blame and judgment? 100%. The whole mess descended into a circus of swirling hurt and anger, spiraling out into widening circles of discontent. Yet, simultaneously, I had a bizarre split experience. Some wiser, cooler part of me watched the performance, shook her head, and said, "It doesn't have to be this way." This other part of me knew that the details of our fight were actually a sideshow. That the real work was waiting to be done underneath all the silly little grenades we were lobbing at each other across the divide. Finally, after what was quite possibly the longest 2 minutes of our marriage, I said, "Let's pause." At first, Nico looked at me like I had truly lost it. "Now you're the wise one," his eyes seemed to say. But to his credit, he shut his mouth. And we actually did pause. We actually did take a breath. In fact, I literally put a hand on my heart, which can sound ridiculous, but is a surprisingly effective way to settle an overactivated nervous system. From there, I sensed my body. Not a pleasant move, since it felt like electricity was racing from my crown to my feet. Speaking of my feet, I could feel them too, and I sensed the way they were rooting me to the earth. I sensed too the cushion I was sitting on and how stable the van was beneath me. And from this received stability, I accessed just enough willpower to turn toward my intention. What do I really want here? Love, of course, support, connection. I was exhausted and frayed, and what I really wanted was for Nico to sit down for a minute and tell me everything was going to be okay. And what was I doing in that delicate moment? Undermining the very support I needed. This contemplation took all of 10 seconds, then another 2 seconds while I clawed through my resistance, my defensiveness, the seeming vulnerability of what I was about to say. "Okay," I said finally, "I'm sorry. I'm just so tired right now." And just like that, the situation shifted again, like we'd found the brakes on the tandem bike. Like we could slow down, pull over to the side of the road together, and find a nice patch of green grass to sit on for a while. "Yeah," Nico said, visibly softening. "I'm tired too." And so we talked about being tired. We talked about how hard it was living in a van. Wonderful, of course, a dream come true, but difficult. And then we talked about how much we both hate having our pictures taken. And Nico's pretty fun. I soon found myself laughing. And then I found myself appreciating all the work he'd been doing on our website and our mailing list and our socials. And then he was appreciating all the teaching I'd been doing lately, and how meaningful it felt, and how lucky we both were to do the work we love. A little while later, we were walking arm in arm to meet our dear friend Isabella. 20 minutes late, but there, fully present and together. So thank you for listening, and I'm going to turn back to Nico.
Yeah, thanks. When we were writing this book, we kind of leaned on this principle that we called it for ourselves, we get real, you know? And that's probably why we ended up telling all of our most embarrassing stories in the book. It was because of this principle, you know, get real. But it's important to us because I think we really have to break this myth that we have in our culture that we call the happily ever after myth. And this is a myth that is true for a lot of areas of life, you know, like if you just get the perfect house or the perfect career, or you get the right car, or you get the right workout routine or diet or whatever you're optimizing at any particular moment, then you will finally have arrived. You will finally be happy and satisfying. But maybe there's no area of life that the happiness, like the happily ever after myth, is more powerful than partnership. Like every romantic comedy ends with two people finding each other, right? There may be all kinds of drama, there may be all kinds of twists and turns, but then you find each other and it's supposed to be smooth sailing once that happens. Is that true? I don't find that necessarily to be true, and it leaves us, I think, very vulnerable to this sense of failure. Like if partnership is difficult and if we're having a hard time, and really almost if anything in our life is difficult, then it's our fault. We should be getting it right. We should be able to do this. And so that's why we start with this principle in the book of get real. And we have these two friends that are Buddhist teachers. And they, when, you know, they got together like in their 40s. So they had been married before. They knew the deal. But when they met, they fell so deeply in love that they had this glowing honeymoon period that lasted a long time, a year or 2 years, until they ended up finally moving in together and driving each other crazy. The kinds of things that you're probably all familiar with, like, what should the fork be facing up in the dishwasher, or should it be facing down in the dishwasher? Or like the way the toilet paper is in the thing really matters a whole lot for some reason. But not only those things, like one of them is a spender and the other one is a saver, and now they're sharing finances, and they just suddenly, you know, they had been so focused on everything, like how perfect the match was and all the things they shared. But now it was like all they could focus on was how different they were and how they didn't agree on anything important, it seemed like. And they're just going around and around and around, talking and talking and talking, trying to get back to that beautiful place where they had been, where everything was so much magic. Until one day they're both like sitting in their living room together, hashing it out, litigating one more time about some utterly minor detail, when one of them turned to the other and said, "Relationships are dukkha." And it was like, oh, relationships are dukkha. And I'm probably all of you are familiar with this word, dukkha, but in case anybody isn't, I'll go into it. It's a great word, you know, Pali word, ancient word. And it often gets translated as suffering, which is kind of a shame because it means so much more than that. You could maybe translate it as unreliability or uncontrollableness or ungovernability, or it's like this, maybe like a rub underneath things. So relationships are dukkha, is that kind of like rub. The etymology of the word is really cool. It's like a wheel that doesn't quite fit right on its axle. So dukkha basically means it's a bumpy ride. And relationships are by nature going to be a bumpy ride. And if you imagine one wheel that's not fitting to an axle, think about two wheels that are both not quite fitting to an axle. And then you get an idea of how bumpy the ride is really going to be. Or you get a whole family system of the different wheels and trying to fit into the axle. You get a whole sangha or a community all trying to fit. And it's all going to be pretty bumpy. Like, not only partnership, but relationships in general are just, this is like the nature of being human in community, in relationship. It's going to be a bumpy ride. And when we can allow for that, like our two friends, these Buddhist teachers did, it's not that the difficulty or the tensions go away. Unfortunately, they don't necessarily go away. But what can drop away is that sense of resistance or failure or the feeling that I'm doing something wrong. And when that resistance to the dukkha drops away, it's like the difficulty itself and the intimacy, the real intimacy, the genuineness of it becomes a kind of dharmic path. It becomes a path of awakening. There's something about meeting that dukkha honestly, unmediated, that makes relationship itself the ground of awakening. Maybe I'll pass it to Devin.
Talking about this has been really revealing. And I think one of the insights we've had, I mean, no matter how much we hear about dukkha as the first noble truth, it's always that revelation, like our friends had, like, wait, oh, like, yeah, dukkha, remember? It's supposed to be this way. And I think one reason why that's always kind of a shock to the system is because our meditation cultures, our dharma cultures are adjacent to the optimization culture, which is a little bit like happily ever after, isn't it? We have this wellness culture now that's kind of thriving in mainstream society where the story is, like Nico was saying, if you just optimize, get the right program that they're really eager to sell you're going to be good. It's going to be smooth sailing. And yet that's a false premise. There's so much extra energy we spend on trying to get it perfect, right? And the Buddha from square one is like, it's futile. Don't even try because it's dukkha, right? First noble truth is dukkha. And for me, at least, this is like the good news, right? The good news about relationships is that they're going to continue to be a bumpy ride. And that's nothing about you. That doesn't mean you're a failure. That doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. That doesn't mean you met the wrong person. Although, of course, in the chapter on dukkha, we talk about caveats. And of course, there's red flags and there's no fly zones and there's always reasons, right, where you actually do need to renegotiate. But relationships, all of them, are going to be rough. And when we admit that, when we allow that, when we surrender to that truth, there's so much more room then for true agency, for learning how we want to practice together. And that in itself is what our book is about. It's like the mess, the compost can actually become the soil from which awakening grows. So then all of our relations, all of our connections become the path for waking up together. And I don't know about for you, but for me, that's what it's about, right? It's about getting to be each other's mirrors. It's about learning about the shadow, all of our unconscious patterns. How do we get to shine those lights for each other so that there is a kind of collective liberation that happens? There's one frame I like to talk about a lot in the Dharma where Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and attendant, is coming with a big insight. And he comes to the Buddha and he says, I had this insight in practice that spiritual friendship is half of the holy life. And the Buddha chides him, actually. He says, "Not so, not so, Ananda. A spiritual friendship is the whole of the holy life." And you've probably heard this teaching before. I did for years, and I just thought, oh, he's talking about the importance of Sangha, which is true. Sangha is very important, it's a refuge. But now, more and more, as we teach about relational practice, I really like to expand this definition much wider. If we think about our being is relationship. We're in relationship. We're connected all the time. It's about the body, right? We're relating to our body. We're relating to the moment. We're relating to our internal experience. We're relating to the world, others around us. Then all of the practice is about spiritual friendship. It's about making friends. It's about practicing skillful, wise, relationality, like we talk about in the book, becomes our path to liberation. And for me, that frame is very inspiring. I want to do it together. So how do we do it? I think the Buddha was actually a very relational teacher. He was in relationship a lot. He was teaching about relationships all the time. And we can see it in our very most foundational text. So many of you are probably familiar with the Satipatthana, Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutta. It's the guide from which we often teach in retreat and courses. So in this sutta, like most, the Buddha repeats himself a lot. He says it actually 13 times in the refrain. He invites us to be mindful internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And in meditation culture, I think we often focus a lot on the internal. We're learning how to meditate. It's really important to turn inside, like we did actually together just now. There's a kind of deep listening internally. We're naming sati, mindfulness, as deep listening. And that already is such a gift to any relationship, isn't it? When you're in alignment with your inner environment and you know what's happening in your own heart, in your own body, and you can bring that to the relational space. But we don't stop there. The Buddha says, be mindful externally. And that we frame as deep listening. So we turn all this warm awareness, this kind attention to the person in front of us. And there's the same curiosity and this deliberate, intentional, like, tell me everything. I want to know what it's like in your world. We feel this often when we love someone, don't we? It's like, I want to know your breakfast cereal and what are your routines? And it's like, tell me all of the inner workings of your heart. We can use that curiosity. It's a kind of mindfulness. It's external sati. And then the third kind of deep listening, this internal and external, we can frame that in lots of interesting ways. And in the book, what we call that is like listening to this third space, listening to the relationship itself. Or we could call that our context. What's the situation? What's the space between us like? And that's a really important, more subtle kind of listening because we can recognize, like, are we tired? Most of our secrets, most embarrassing stories in this book are about being super tired and then being unskillful with each other because we're so exhausted. So that's listening to the third space. Or did we just move across the country? Or is one of us grieving, the passing of a loved one? How is it? And I think, especially in friendships, maybe, or any family relation, deep relation, this one is often overlooked. I don't know about you, but I have longtime friends that I just feel like, oh, yeah, it's supposed to be just static as it always is. But my best friend Annie from second grade, we're very different. Our relationship has taken so many different twists and turns. And part of listening to the third space is we're kind of opposite. We have different lives. But when I tune to that and I allow her to be her and me to be me, there's a lot of shared life in there that we can connect around, even though we're so different. So this three-way listening is like nitty-gritty, how do we do this in real time? And so one of the practices we offer, and we invite you actually in creative ways to find, how do you practice this three-way listening with another person who might also be interested? This doesn't necessarily have to be your partner. But one way we talk about the check-in, right? Checking in with each other. And now some of you have probably done this. Dharma teachers, we start meetings by checking in with each other. Like, it seems like a simple practice, check in on how you're doing. But when we bring this kind of intentional mindfulness to the space, it transforms it into a collective awakening practice. So we recommend having a timer. Often Nico and I will set for 5 minutes, but you could do even smaller, smaller scaffolding. 5 minutes feels like a long time to check in often in the beginning. So, you could do 2 minutes each. And there's a real framework and agreement where the speaker speaks, the listener listens, and there isn't crosstalk, there isn't interruption, there isn't even questions. And it takes some practice to learn because it's mindful speaking and listening, and then you switch. And then there can be kind of a third space, maybe another 2 minutes, 2-2-2 or 5-5-5, where you're debriefing, you're kind of repeating back, mentioning what you heard, maybe talking about any responses you might have. You could ask more questions. And all of these are skills that we develop, just like we develop mindfulness on the cushion. So we're huge fans of the check-in. We do it often. But your person might not be. And that's perfectly fine too. Sometimes we have a lot of myths, about what mindful people do. And sometimes we think, oh, mindful people have a lot of emotions that they want to check in about. Mindful people love checking in. But some of our most deeply spiritual people, they're like, we don't want to check in with you. We just want to like go for a walk. Can we just like have a normal meal? So if you're with someone who's not into checking in, totally fine. Maybe your way is to collage together. Or have a moment where you just breathe in silence. So there's lots of ways you can practice this together and be creative. That's the invitation, is to find ways. And if it feels uncomfortable, sometimes the check-in can feel like a cognitive burden. You've finished a long day at the end of a long week, and maybe that just looks like, cuddling together or spending some intentional time before you go to bed. Or making a date that over the weekend, where you're going to do a 15-minute check-in like that. So we have to respond to our particular context. That's the third listening. But there's lots to say, about how we practice this, how we agree together to listen internally, externally, and both. There's a bunch more in the book. We have a whole middle section on balance. The Buddha taught in his very first Dharma talk, he talked about the middle way. And so I think there's a whole middle way of partnership or relationship where we start to learn, like, I've got needs, they've got needs. How do we balance those? The difference between always needing, expecting my needs to be met, or always being kind of the one who's like in service to the other. There's habits like that. There's balancing needs of autonomy and connection. But I think all of these middle way practices, these balancings, they're fed by internal, external, both, that kind of listening. Skillful conflict. We talk a lot about conflict in the book because let's just say, like, meditation culture can be a little bit conflict averse. Not always, but there can be that sense of mindful people never argue, never get reactive. And I think that's somewhat we're trying to dismantle that myth because we have conflict and we tell about it in the book. So we talk about there's three different conflict styles, and then the art of that is really understanding what is your personal style in any particular relationship and learning to work with it. And then we have a section in the end that's really about practicing appreciation, like mudita practice, delighting in, who you are with this person, who the other person is. A kind of gratitude practice specifically for your loved ones. And that appreciation, that gratitude practice is really fed actually by Marana-sati, by contemplation of death. Because when we're very aware that, these moments are fleeting, we don't know how long we have left, we don't know how long the other person has left, that, the forks facing up or down in the dishwasher don't matter so much. When we're not taking these moments for granted, there's a contemplation in the preliminary practices in the Vajrayana that talks about really contemplating the fact that every meeting ends in separation. And not to be morbid about it, but really the impact when we contemplate that in an honest way is we want to wake up. You know, each moment is precious. We appreciate the other one because we really don't know how long. It's so humbling that way. So we call it death is the mother of beauty because there's a poignancy and a tenderness that comes when we're that honest, when we're that real. Do you want to dedicate the merit, Nico?
Well, there is so much goodness when we come together in this way. Let's share it. Share that goodness with everyone that we meet and everyone they meet. May that goodness spread into our communities and into our cities and our towns. And may every being everywhere be happy and safe and well. Thanks, friends. Good to be with you.